Sai Ram from Prashanti Nilayam. Dear listeners, Radio Sai continues its weekly presentation of the talking book version of Mr. Howard Moffat's highly acclaimed book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. The author was among the very early Westerners who came to Satya Sai Baba as a skeptic in 1964, and drawn by his enigma, he stayed for considerable periods of time near him in the next 6 years. During this period, he conducted extensive research and probing investigations into the Sai phenomena. He published his findings as the book that has become a classic of Sai literature, often considered the primer which introduced Sri Satya Sai Baba to millions round the world. This book was first published in 1971. Since then, it has been instrumental in drawing millions of seekers to the loving path of Satya Sai. These readings, dear listeners, are being aired every week, and if you wish to revisit a chapter at any time, you can do so at our website radiosai.org. So dear listeners, welcome now to Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Howard Moffat.
Sai Ram, and welcome to this talking book session of excerpts from Mr. Howard Moffat's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. We are now at chapter 13. It is entitled, The Question of Saving from Death. This chapter starts off with a quote from Sri Aurobindo, who said, quote, "Even there shall come, as a high crown of all the end of death, the death of ignorance," unquote. While till now we have only heard Mr. Moffat narrate accounts of how Sri Satya Sai Baba saved his devotees from terrible diseases, here is an overwhelming account of how Swami resurrected a devotee long after he was dead.
Mr. V. Radhakrishna, who is a factory owner and well-known citizen in Kuppam, Andhra Pradesh, was about 60 years of age when in 1953 he paid a visit to Puttaparthi. With him on this occasion went his wife, his daughter Vijaya, and the latter's husband, Mr. K.S. Hemchand. Vijaya was about 18 and had not been long married. Her father, she told me, was at the time suffering from gastric ulcers with various complications. He was really in a very bad way, and one of his reasons for visiting the ashram was the hope that he might get relief from his frightful suffering. He had known Baba for some time. The great religious festival of Dasara was on, and a good number of people were visiting Puttaparthi. Mr. Radhakrishna was given a room in the same building where Swami lived, and spent all his time on his bed there. Once when Baba came to visit him, Radhakrishna said that he would prefer to die rather than go on suffering the way he was. Swami simply laughed at this and made no promise of either healing him or letting him die. One evening, Radhakrishna went into a coma and his breathing was that of a dying man. Alarmed, the wife dashed off to see Swami. The latter came to the room, looked at the patient and said, "Don't worry, everything will be all right," and left. On the next day, the patient was still unconscious. Mr. K.S. Hemchand, the son-in-law, brought a male nurse of the district who, after failing to find any pulse and making other examinations, gave as his opinion that Mr. Radhakrishna was so near death that there was no possibility of saving him. About an hour after this, the patient became very cold. The three anxious relatives heard what they thought was the death rattle in his throat and watched him turning blue and stiff. Vijaya and her mother went to see Baba, who was at the time upstairs in his dining room. When they told him that Radhakrishna seemed to be dead, he laughed and walked away to his bedroom. Vijaya and her mother returned to the room of the dead man and waited. After a while, Swami came in, looked at the body, but went away again without saying or doing anything. That was on the evening of the second day since Mr. Radhakrishna had become unconscious. The whole of the next night passed while the three stayed awake and anxiously watched for any signs of returning life. There were no signs. Yet they still had faith that Baba would somehow or other in his own way save Radhakrishna. But had he not said everything would be all right? On the morning of the third day, the body was more than ever like a corpse. Dark, cold, quite stiff, and beginning to smell. Other people who came to see and sympathize told Mrs. Radhakrishna that she should have the corpse removed from the ashram. But she replied, "Not unless Swami orders it." Some even went to Baba and suggested that as the man was dead and the body smelling of decomposition, it should either be sent back to Kuppam or cremated at Puttaparthi. Swami simply replied, "We'll see." When Mrs. Radhakrishna went upstairs again to tell Baba what people were saying to her and ask him what she must do, he answered, "Do not listen to them and have no fear. I am here." Then he said that he would come down to see her husband soon. She went downstairs again and waited with her daughter and son-in-law by the body. The minutes dragged by, an hour passed, but Swami did not come. Then, when they were beginning to despair entirely, the door opened and there stood Baba in his red robe, copious hair and shining smile. It was then about 2:30 in the afternoon of the third day. Mrs. Radhakrishna went towards Baba and burst into tears. Vijaya too began to cry. They were like Martha and Mary, the sisters of Lazarus, weeping before their Lord who, they thought, had come too late. Gently Baba asked the tearful women and sorrowful Mr. Hemchand to leave the room. As they left, he closed the door behind them. They do not know. No man knows what happened in that room, where there were only Swami and the dead man. But after a few minutes, Baba opened the door and beckoned the waiting ones in. There, on the bed, Radhakrishna was looking up at them, smiling. Amazingly, the stiffness of death had vanished and his natural color was returning. Baba went over, stroked the patient's head and said to him, "Talk to them. They are worried." "Why worried?" asked Radhakrishna, puzzled. "I am all right." "You are here." Swami turned to the wife. "I have given your husband back to you," he said. "Now get him a hot drink." When she brought it, Swami himself fed it to Radhakrishna with a spoon. For another 1/2 hour, he remained there, strengthening the man he had raised. Then he blessed the whole family, placing his hand on Mrs. Radhakrishna's head and left the room. Next day, the patient was strong enough to walk to bhajan. On the third day, he wrote a 7-page letter to one of his daughters who was abroad in Italy. The family stayed a few more days at Prashanthi Nilayam, then with Baba's permission, returned to their home in Kuppam. The bad gastric ulcers and complications had vanished forever. When I spoke to Mr. Radhakrishna himself about the experience, I asked if he had any memories at all of the time he was unconscious and to all appearances dead. He replied, "No. When I became conscious again, I first thought that it was just the same day. Later they told me it had been 3 days I was unconscious, that I was dead and actually starting to stink. But Swami can do anything he wishes. He is God." When is a person dead? Does any man know? Some who have seemed dead by all medical tests have in fact returned to their bodies, often, unfortunately, after being placed in their tombs as evidence of movements by corpses seen later has proved. When Jesus received word that Lazarus was dead, he said to his disciples, "Our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep."
When Professor N. Kasturi was writing something about the incident of how Mr. Radhakrishna was raised from the dead, Baba told him to put the word "dead" in inverted commas. Maybe we should say here that Mr. Radhakrishna may have been clinically dead, but not quite so until Baba pronounced him so. But to what extent is this specific ailment or the approach of death karmic? And how far would Swami interfere with the patient's karma? Mr. Murfitt now recollects 2 cases within the same family. One where it seems the claims of karma could be put aside, and the other, where it is wiser not to interfere.
Once, when Mr. G. Venkatamuni's mother, nearly 80 years old, was so close to death that all relatives had been warned of her imminent end, his wife Sushila took a japamala given her by Sai Baba and placed it on the old lady's breast. Baba had told Sushila that the japamala could be used in emergency as a healing charm. The patient immediately began to show marked signs of improvement. This happened about 10 o'clock one evening, and when next morning a number of close relatives arrived, summoned to bid the old lady a last farewell, she asked in a puzzled tone why they had all come. She was soon hale and hearty again and lived several years more. Later, however, when one of G. Venkatamuni's sons, an epileptic, took very ill and seemed to be dying, Sushila decided to use the Sai Baba Japamala to try to save the boy. She went to bring it from where it was, lying among other things, in a case in the family puja room. But she came back without it, telling her husband in a distressed and bewildered tone that she could not get hold of the Japamala. She had tried to pick it up several times, but each time it had somehow eluded her hand. She could not explain the strange thing, an object seeming to avoid her grasp. What could it mean? Talking it over, husband and wife could only decide that, for some reason, Baba did not want the charm used on this occasion. The boy died. Soon afterwards, the parents called to see Baba. They had often listened to his wise words on the true nature of death, yet they were but human and wore long, sad faces. Moreover, they were a little hurt to find that Baba himself was far from mournful. In fact, he was cheerful and smiling. He said to them, "You must not sorrow over the boy. I have just seen him again, and he is very happy over there. He had just a little karma to work out here on earth, and when he had completed that, he was ready to go. It was much better, much happier for him to go." Then the parents understood that they had really only been sorry for themselves in their loss, and they were comforted to know that the boy they loved, who seemed dead, was in fact alive and well beyond his suffering physical body. Mr. and Mrs. Venkatamuni's faith in Sai Baba did not for a moment waver. For instance, Mr. V. Hanumantarao, mentioned earlier, had a sick son who had developed polio at the age of about 6 months. To make matters worse, the boy was an only child. Mr. and Mrs. Hanumantarao met Sai Baba when their son was about 4 years old. The young, lovable Swami became like one of the family. But he puzzled the couple by often referring to their child as "my boy," and he always called the little fellow Shiva, although his name was actually Ishwari Prasad Dattatreya. Swami would often say to them, "Shiva is the rope that brought us together and holds us so." The parents did not understand this and many of the young Swami's sayings, but he performed uplifting miracles in their presence, and they had great hopes that he would cure their son. The boy was very happy when Baba was present, but his health grew worse. Polio affected the brain, there were frequent fits, and after a few years, little Shiva died. And with his death, the rope was broken. The bereaved parents stopped seeing Sai Baba. No doubt, they felt that he had somehow failed them. Yet the time they had spent with him, his elevating spiritual influence, his silent and his spoken teachings had had a profound effect upon them. Soon after the death of his beloved son, Mr. Hanumantarao devoted a large part of his fortune to establishing and maintaining in Madras an orthopedic center for children crippled with polio. The center, one of the few of its kind in India, is named after the little boy, Ishwari Prasad Dattatreya, to whom it is a memorial. The children there are given medical, surgical and rehabilitation treatment and a regular education. It lies just across the Adyar River from the Theosophical Society headquarters, and I have several times called there to see Mr. Hanumantarao. I have watched the joy that lights the faces of the young cripples when the old retired transport commissioner walks into wards or classrooms. Also, I have seen them in wheelchairs or held up by frames and crutches, saluting with deep reverence the bust of little Ishwari, which stands in the hospital entrance. They feel that, in a certain way, he died for them, that it is his spirit which has brought them modern scientific help in their sufferings and the hope of a happier life. When this couple had triumphed over their great sorrow and turned it to a worthy and constructive end, a veil seemed to fall from their eyes. They saw how wrong they had been in blaming Sai Baba for not keeping their boy alive. As Mr. Hanumant Rao said to me, there must be suffering in the world. It belongs to the nature of things here because man brings it on himself. They understand that the Divine One cannot lift all the karma from man's shoulders, and also that much good can in fact come out of what seems to be evil from our limited viewpoint. So Mr. and Mrs. Hanumant Rao return to the one who for them is the focus of divinity on earth today, and they were among his most deeply devoted disciples. In their home, they keep a special bedroom set aside for Sai Baba. The room is never given to anyone else, and their constant prayer is that Baba will grace it whenever possible with his presence.
In a number of cases where Sai Baba has not cured or saved, Mr. Murfitt notes an inner and really much more important miracle. Swami has, he writes, perhaps cured the desire to be cured and brought acceptance. He has healed the soul wounds of loss and lifted minds and hearts to a better understanding of life.
It is the same pattern now as it was long ago at Shirdi. Then and there he healed and saved the lives of many. But some he did not save. One of these was the daughter of his great devotee, H.S. Dikshit. So people murmured, if Sai Baba could not save Dikshit's daughter at Shirdi, what is the good of a Sadguru? On this point, the profound Sai Baba apostle, B.V. Narasimha, writes, one might as well say, when dear ones die, what is the good of God? Faith is not a guarantee that there will be no death or evil in the world in life. But, as in the case of Dikshit, intense faith makes the devotee brace himself up against all inevitable calamities and learn more and more of God's scheme for our life. Life is not intended to be a bed of roses and a treasure house of wealth. Faith enables the devotee to see what life is and what God's plan is, and improve his own attitude to life. In this, as in former incarnation, Sai Baba has sometimes said that to cure a certain person, to save from death, or to remove some inborn physical blemish would be to interfere unduly with the person's karma. And in such cases, he has left the person concerned to bear that cross. Likewise, with regard to death, generally, I think time of death is not strictly preordained. There are several points. Let us say, along our lifeline, when you could meet with death. But it is not an absolute karmic necessity that you should die at the first or second of these points. Nevertheless, in man's present state, death is an essential to the pattern of life, and in the end, every man must die. Though Lazarus was called back from the tomb, several years later, he died. And so must any man whose life Sai Baba saves. When that final point comes, at which it is best to die, at which it is unwise and detrimental to the soul to prolong life, then what enlightened saint would interfere? The Illuminati, the Godmen, the great yogis know when that right time is for those who come to them, as of course they do for themselves. When the ancient writings say that the yogi conquers death, they do not mean that he lives forever. They mean that he himself decides the right time for him to depart this earth. And then he goes, leaving his body consciously of his own volition.
Well, that has been a heavy dose, and we shall stop at this point. More when we get together again. Meanwhile, all the best, and Jai Sai Ram. You have been listening to a presentation of excerpts from Mr. Howard Murfitt's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. This book has been published in 1971 by Frederick Miller Limited in London.